From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Within 2 days of her arrival last November at John Peter Smith Hospital, it was agreed by all that 33-year-old Marlies Munoz was brain dead. But she was also 14 weeks pregnant, and the Fort Worth, Texas hospital insisted, over her family's objections, on putting her on life support to save the fetus. Required by Texas law, the hospital said. On Friday, a judge said no, let her go. It's been a disturbing case. This hour on Point, life and death and the law in Texas. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What just happened here in Texas? Do you know the law in your state? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. It was quite a saga as the family struggled for her to be taken off of life support, the hospital refusing, citing Texas law. Earlier this month, Marlies Munoz's mother, Lynn Machado, spoke to CBS News about her daughter.
I break down and I cry because I know in my heart my daughter's gone. But to see her shell there and being forced to be alive, it's hard to see her when we feel like we're caught in this limbo.
Forced to be alive, but brain dead. Talking with reporters on Fridays, the Munoz family attorney Heather King said the family is relieved after the judge's decision to take Marlies Munoz off life support.
This was a sad situation all the way around. We are relieved that Eric Munoz can now move forward with the process of burying his wife.
But there was no unanimity on this in Texas, a very strong right-to-life state. Here was Republican State Representative Matt Krause saying he spent the weekend trying to get the hospital and the district attorney's office to appeal the ruling, go ahead and try to save that fetus.
We don't know what kind of problems he or she may have faced had they survived and been able to have life, but they still would have been given a chance at life.
Incredible case. Joining me now from Dallas is Diane Jennings. She's a reporter with the Dallas Morning News, been following this case very closely. Diane, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Do we know the status of the remains of Marlies Munoz at this point? The body's been released to the family. Has it been buried? Do we know?
No, I don't think we know. I haven't had any sort of contact with the family's attorneys today. They did release a statement yesterday, and I believe that the remains have been released to her family, but I don't know what they've done with them at this point.
Was it clear that she was immediately fully dead when they took her off life support? Was it just as simple as that?
They haven't released, the hospital has not released anything that I have gotten, and what the family attorneys released was just that she was now at rest.
Does it seem that the hospital considered making an appeal of this judge's ruling last week?
Yeah, I think that's what was a little bit surprising to everybody there Friday afternoon. As one person said, you would have thought they would have been prepared for either eventuality, that they would immediately issue a statement, yes, we will appeal, or no, we won't. So the fact that they waited over the weekend was very surprising to a lot of people, because it did seem to indicate to those of us who'd followed the case that they were thinking pretty seriously about appealing, and that was a bit of a surprise. We expected them to know immediately whether they would appeal or not.
The testimony that came out last week indicated that her body was in seriously bad shape, even as they were trying, under the law apparently, to save this fetus. I mean, they're talking about the body decomposing in the hospital bed, putrefaction going on. It's kind of unimaginable scene, Diane.
Yeah, that was the pretty horrific part, though. The attorneys released a statement earlier in the week talking about the condition of the fetus and what that was going through. But then right before the hearing, they issued an affidavit from the husband in which he just described in heartbreaking detail just what it was like to see his wife's body. And it was pretty wrenching. I think both sides of this issue agree that this family has just been through hell.
The judge said her dead body is deteriorating. The husband said when he leans toward her, he can smell death on the body, having to endure the pain, he said in a statement, of watching my wife's dead body be treated as if she were still alive. Diane, what's the law under which the hospital took this course of action?
It's a very short short clause that says that a hospital cannot withhold life-sustaining life support from a woman who is pregnant. The problem is that it was not one doctor said, well, it's very clear, and others have said it's very broad. So it's a kind of how you interpret it. But it was not, from the people that I've talked to that were in on the drafting of the law, this was not a scenario that anyone envisioned.
We're going to talk with one of them in a moment. What about this particular decision? Was something about this hospital or its administration or the politics of its community that might have teed it up to be more aggressive in asserting this law in this case?
Yeah, I think that's the question that a lot of people have that we really don't have answers to, and it didn't come out on Friday, is that who made this decision to keep her on life support? Who made the decision? Several people have said to me it couldn't have been just one physician. It would have had to have gone up higher to administration and to legal counsel and so on and so forth. And so there's a lot of theories on what the thinking is behind it, that the hospital is just being extremely cautious, or that there is perhaps some political pandering going on to a conservative base. And so it's really unknown at this point. I think that's what people would like to know, is who made this decision and why. And again, I think that they are saying that they were simply following the law. They did issue a statement, I believe, over the weekend that said they were not trying to make the law. They simply were trying to follow it. So they may have just been trying to be very conservative. But I think there is a real question here, because most people say that the law, that even before the judge's decision, what people, legal scholars that I kept talking to said, this did not apply to a dead body. This applied to a pregnant patient, but not to a dead body, and that she has been dead since November 28th. They did not officially declare her dead, however, and so that was one thing that the judge had to order them to do, was to pronounce her dead, even though they did stipulate in the hearing that she was, in fact, dead since November 28th.
That's a long time. What an amazing story. She and her husband, Eric, Marlies and Eric, both paramedics. He had actually resuscitated her, working on her on the way to the hospital. But then the husband and her parents, the entire family, very clear that this was not something that she had ever wanted.
Yeah, I think that's what was interesting in this case, is that this was not a case of parents wanting one thing and the husband wanting the other. They were very united on what they wanted and what their wife and daughter wanted. She did work as a paramedic. She and her husband both had experience with seeing these type of thing. And apparently she did not issue a written directive. The hospital did point out she did not issue a written directive, but she had made it clear to her husband and her parents what she wanted. And her husband, when she was incapacitated, becomes her spokesman. And he was very clear. I had an email from somebody who said, well, why is this such a big deal? And the point for the husband was, he said, I want to honor my wife's wishes. This is not what she wanted. This was not her choice at her end of life, and that it should have been her choice.
Diane Jennings with the Dallas Morning News. Thank you very much for joining us, Diane.
Thank you.
Back in December, her husband, Marlies Munoz's husband, Eric, explained that his wife's end of life wishes had been clear, talking with WFAA-TV.
We talked about it. We are both paramedics. We've seen things out in the field. And, you know, we both knew that we didn't want to be on life support.
But she was, for a long, long time. Against her wishes, her husband says they're against his wishes, against the wishes of her parents, but the hospital saying this is the law and life support will go on. Tom Mayo joins us right now from Dallas, law professor, medical ethicist, professor of law at Southern Methodist University. In 1999, he helped draft the Texas Advanced Directives Act concerning end-of-life care. Tom Mayo, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
What do you think of the hospital's interpretation of the law that kept Marlies Munoz on life support until she was decomposing in the hospital bed?
Well, I think the hospital just plain got it wrong. The law certainly is aimed at providing a mechanism for making treatment decisions for patients who are alive. And although there was some question about whether Ms. Munoz was actually dead until it was conceded by the hospital, now that we know, there's just no good argument in my mind for applying this statute to her.
How did it escape your attention back in 1999 that it might be applied this way? I mean, it says a person may not withdraw or withhold life-sustaining treatment under this subchapter from a pregnant patient. She was pregnant. Did it ever occur to you that the law might be applied in this way?
Well, it didn't, at least not to me, and we didn't have a discussion at the time about applying the statute to someone who had died. The key language, which I think helps explain what our frame of reference was at the time, is under this subchapter. This subchapter is a reference to a part of the law where that pregnancy exclusion does appear. It's a part of the law that deals with making decisions for patients with terminal or irreversible conditions. Either a living will or a surrogate decision maker can make treatment decisions for someone who cannot make decisions for herself. The key definitions here are irreversible condition and terminal condition. And it's, to my mind, crystal clear that only a living person can have a terminal condition or an irreversible condition, as those terms are defined. So once you apply the definitions to this subchapter and focus on the fact that the pregnancy exclusion is limited to withholding and withdrawing life support under this subchapter, it's a pretty big stretch to apply this outside the subchapter to someone who's dead.
But the law was quite willing, was it not, to override the will, even the expressed will of a patient in a circumstance where they were in trouble and they were pregnant. Life-sustaining treatment, that's life support. You were ready to run over their will.
Well, not eagerly. This is a provision of law that has been on the books in Texas since 1977. We were, in 99, putting three statutes together, trying to improve them where we could. But this particular provision was one that we did not want to alter.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about life and death in Texas. The brain-dead pregnant woman the hospital would not let die. Now she has life support withdrawn after a judge's ruling at the end of last week. But the whole country's been watching this, trying to understand. Tom Mayo is with us, law professor, medical ethicist. He's at Southern Methodist University. Way back in 1999, he helped draft the law that was cited in the hospital's decision that kept Marlies Munoz alive for week after week after week. Joins us today from Dallas. Joe Poyman joins us from Austin, Texas. Joe is executive director of the Texas Alliance for Life. He was in support of the hospital's position. Joe Poyman, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. Glad to be here.
And with us from Austin, Texas, Andrea Grimes, senior political reporter at RH Reality Check. It's a web publication that delivers news, commentary, analysis on reproductive health, covers reproductive issues in Texas and across the South. Andrea Grimes, thank you for joining us today.
Happy to be here, Tom. Thanks.
Joel, let me come to you. You were in support of the hospital's position. The judge ruled against it. Why do you think the hospital was on the right track in keeping Marlies Munoz alive, even as her body began to putrefy, we're told, in the hospital bed?
Tom, I think in cases like this, we have to recognize, and I think this was the intent of the legislature when the law was drafted in 1999. I'll point out that I was there with Tom Mayo in drafting that law.
Okay.
The intent of the legislature is that there are two patients. There's the mother, the pregnant mother, and the unborn child. And in various places in Texas law, the intent of the legislature is to protect the interests of that unborn child as a separate individual patient. We have that in our criminal law. We have that an unborn child can inherit property. An unborn child getting a possession is protected an individual person from crimes, violent crimes of assault and murder. And we have people serving life sentences in Texas for murdering an unborn child, sometimes when the mother dies, sometimes when the mother doesn't die. But that has been the expressed intent of the legislature. It's not an abortion issue because abortion continues to be remained legal in Texas. Most abortions are legal. That's because of the U.S. Supreme Court. But the U.S. Supreme Court does allow Texas to recognize the personhood of an unborn child for other reasons. And we think this is one of those manifestations of the intent of the legislature.
But Joe, at 14 weeks, she was considered brain dead by the hospital. Her husband, who knew her well, said she didn't want life support. Her family, her mother and father said she didn't want life support. The fetus was only at 14 weeks. How can you put that against the wishes of the woman herself and all of her family saying, please let her die?
Well, I think the hospital's interpretation of the law was a pretty reasonable interpretation. Now that judge has overruled that, but the law, that statute is pretty clear that the law that allows a physician to remove or withhold life-sustaining treatments, something that keeps a patient alive, does not apply when a woman is pregnant. And that had been the case in Texas for at least 20 years. And I understand quite a number of the states have similar provisions. So that hospital was just reading the law. I think the black letter law. Now, A lot of us didn't know that there was a medical determination that she was brain dead. I have to concede that's not so clear. That's kind of legal, uncharted territory. We did not anticipate that, or I don't recall discussing that around the table when the issue groups, including Professor Mayo, were drafting this law back in 1999. But I think what the hospital came up with was a pretty reasonable interpretation. But the policy, in our view, is always to recognize two patients. You know, if the woman is not responsive and she's alive, that's certainly a patient. The unborn child she is carrying in her womb is also a patient. And whatever policy the state adopts should recognize both of those interests.
But where's the limit, Joe? I mean, now that you know she was brain dead, in this case, and they're citing the state, this law is the reason to keep her alive. It seems like the state coming in to turn the woman into a lifeless machine, just kind of a incubator, even in death, where does her dignity come into play here?
Well, that is certainly a concern. And again, there are two patients, and yeah, this is a very tragic situation, and our hearts, you know, our organization is very sympathetic to the husband and her parents, you know, Mr. Munoz. This is just a really, really difficult case. But, you know, and we've heard of cases where a pregnant woman and brain dead, her body was kept on life support for a matter of weeks, including a case a few years ago here in Austin. I think it was about 5 or 6 weeks. That child was delivered alive and continued to be healthy.
Andrea Grimes, join us here. Joe, stand by. Andrea Grimes in Austin, Texas. Help us understand, I mean, to many people around the country, this just seemed unimaginable. And yet, maybe under Texas law, it's not so unimaginable. What's the cultural, legal, political context that you see here, Andrea, around this hospital's insistence on this path of enforcement on its own hook for so many weeks?
Well, I certainly think that there are many, many folks in Texas who have a preoccupation, perhaps with the fetishization of fetuses, and people who would put the fetus ahead of the dignity and well-being of a pregnant person. Certainly, that's a common view among many of our conservative and anti-choice politicians here. What I think was so surprising in this case was how clear Marlies Munoz's medical condition was. We knew that she had been, you know, without oxygen for over an hour. You know, there was talk of her being brain dead for many, many weeks. And fundamentally, you know, she collapsed when the fetus was only at 14 weeks of development. And so I think really the shock here, even among very reasonable, you know, your kind of middle of the road, you know, moderate Texan, there was a lot of surprise that, you know, a hospital would step in and presume to speak for, you know, people who knew her best. And I think a lot of people, you know, were absolutely shocked to find that Texas had this law on the books and that it would be interpreted in this way by the powers that be at the hospital. Again, it's unclear, you know, who ultimately made that decision to keep her on, you know, on these machines, to keep her corpse, you know, as some kind of ghoulish incubator for a non-viable fetus. You know, I think it would be disingenuous to say that, you know, Texans rallied behind her and rallied behind the hospital and thought that what the hospital was doing was correct. You know, there was a lot of debate here.
Were politicians stepping up or hiding from this, Andrea? Was Rick Perry out there? He's been very outspoken on abortion. Was he talking about this or others?
You know, there were definitely some Tea Party leaning politicians in North Texas, Matt Krause among them, who said, you know, that they would stop at nothing to keep Marlies's body on life support, and they needed to stand for the fetus. There was an anti-choice pastor out of North Texas, you know, who said that someone should have been appointed to defend the fetus. You know, certainly, you know, the anti-choice interest groups try to make this into a political issue in their favor, And I think that was really tasteless. And, you know, it was really disturbing to see people picketing outside court hearings and, you know, picketing outside the hospital, you know, at this family that was in such trauma, going through such trauma, and folks trying to make this into a political argument rather than, respecting the wishes of the family, which, you know, they really just kind of wanted to be left alone and wanted to be allowed to, say goodbye to their wife and daughter.
And they wanted their wife and daughter to be left alone, allowed to fully die as well. Andrea Grimes, Joe Poyman, Tom Mayo, please stand by in Texas. Donna in Williamsburg, Virginia. Donna, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, Tom. I think it's terribly sad that families are being subjected to the choices that institutions, be they religious, political, whatever, want to impose on them. And they wish that these families would make choices that once these families make these choices to bring these lives forward, whether they're wanted or unwanted, these institutions then retreat when these families need the kind of support that they may need in order to bring these people into adulthood in a healthy manner. I believe that this was politicized because there was an interest in promoting a right-wing political organization, whatever that may have been, and there was no interest in the family. And I think some people are extreme and they're unreasonable, and they should not be engaged in the choices that families make. And God bless the Menendez family.
But yes, the Munoz, I'm for that. But this, of course, the hospital was right there. They saw exactly what was going on, and they held the line until the judge said, stop. Donna, thanks for your call. Steve in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
Tom, one point of fact that is not clear. Ms. Munoz collapsed when the fetus was 14 weeks old, and then she was in the hospital for another 14 weeks. Is that it?
Until the fetus was 22 weeks. So we're talking, you know, more like 8 more weeks, a couple of months.
Okay. Tom, medical practitioners always consider the life of the fetus in treating a pregnant woman. That is standard, and it's enshrined. The life of the fetus is also enshrined in our criminal system.
But she was brain dead, and the fetus was 14 weeks old. I mean, that's far from viable.
But the life of the fetus, if a woman can be charged for abuse of the fetus, a third party can be charged for attacking a woman and hurting a fetus.
What about the woman's own desire here, as expressed by her husband? What about the desire of her family, Steve?
I'm getting to that, Tom.
Yeah.
First of all, there was no written document. Second of all, we don't know for a fact that Ms. Munoz considered what would happen if she were pregnant and if she had a viable pregnancy or a viable fetus. We don't really know what was in her mind. All we know is what the family says.
Now, her husband says he knew. Isn't that enough in this case?
Excuse me?
Her husband says he knew. Her mother and father.
It hasn't been clear to me that he knew what his wife would have wanted had she known she would have been pregnant. And he hasn't been clear on that. And I have tremendous sympathy for the family. But then again, the life of a patient in a hospital and the life of the unborn fetus has to be considered. And the families don't have absolute authority on what happens to a patient in a hospital.
I want to look at those rights, Steve. I appreciate your call and that perspective. Let me get one more, and I'll take it to our Texas panel. Nick in Nashville. Thank you for calling, Nick. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I'm a resident physician, and I guess my overwhelming question is maybe that the law is even beside the point, and I think I'm just echoing what a previous caller said, is that the futility of care is a question that I have, that this woman, and I'm not very familiar with her medical state, the prognosis seems so poor and the fetus so far from viability that it seemed to be futile to be keeping this patient alive. And I wonder if the whole discussion of the law is even necessary at that point.
Tom Mayo, it seems that that may come to you. Here's a physician calling from Nashville that says, you know, was this in any way viable? I mean, could it have been somehow viable, Tom? You're talking about with brain death, they're trying to keep the body functioning enough to support the fetus with machines, but It doesn't look like that was working. The fetus was in terrible shape and the body was putrefying.
Well, I think we have to be, excuse me, very careful about how we describe Ms. Munoz's condition. There was no question about trying to keep her alive. There was no question about removing life support so that she could be allowed to die. She was dead on November 28th, and that's been conceded now by everyone. Brain dead is dead in Texas and in every state in the union. And so I think that what we're really talking about here is not futility of care for her, but whether it would have been seen as futile to try to continue the pregnancy until the fetus was viable.
But a fetus isn't generally considered not viable at all until more like 23 weeks or somewhere in there?
Oh, at an absolute minimum. 24 or 25 is probably closer to it. And that's when we have a fetus that is otherwise healthy. The huge question hanging over this case for these last 8 weeks was how injured was the fetus as a result of either the lack of oxygen for over an hour back in November or the mother's deteriorating condition over the last 2 months.
And it turns out it was deeply injured. It was deeply troubled fetus.
Right.
Was the hospital, does it look to you, Tom, they were trying to get to that 23-week mark or 24 and then let Marlies go and bring the fetus out? I mean, I've read that if you did that at that point, the odds of that if the child were somehow to live, the odds of it having more than an IQ of 70 would be very unlikely.
Well, I'm not a medical person, but I'm sure from the public statements the hospital made that they were aiming for 24 or 25 weeks for an evaluation, according to their public statements. But at that age of gestation, we're talking about a lengthy stay in a neonatal ICU. And we know what the statistics are on babies born that early. A number of them die, and a large number of them have medical problems that persist for their whole life.
Joe Poyman, given what you know now, are you reconsidering your support for the hospital's position here? Would it have been better to follow the family's desire right at the beginning and just let this all go?
Well, I think that we have to remember that when you have different patients and a very small patient, you know, in this case, this unborn child, the family is, we give great deference to the family, but the family's not always right. Same with a newborn child born with disabilities. The family might say, do nothing. Maybe that the hospital has to step
in. Joe, you're breaking up on us, but I think we've got the main point. Joe Poyman there with the Texas Alliance for Life, and Andrea Grimes, just half a minute before the break here. Thank you, Joe. Andrea, can this happen again, or does Texas learn something from this, you think, that will put a stop to this?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, obviously, people have really strong feelings on both sides of these issues. I do know that the Munoz and the Machado family have considered taking their concerns to the legislature. So this is something that we might hear, you know, next year when the ledge meets again. This is something that could come up for debate. But, you know, it's going to be very politically touchy for a lot of conservatives that really want to toe that right wing line.
We will look right on across the country at the national picture of law and the health of a pregnant woman, of a fetus, in a situation of brain death in this case. Andrea Grimes with RH Reality Check. There have been a lot of reporting on reproductive health in Texas. Joining us today from Austin. Andrea, thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about life and death in Texas. The brain-dead pregnant woman the hospital would not let die. Tom Mayo is with us from Dallas, Texas, law professor, medical ethicist, professor at Southern Methodist University, helped draft the law that was cited by the hospital in this very controversial case that's attracted attention all over the country. As of Friday, a judge said, no more life support. Let her go. The hospital has, and the family now has the remains of Marlies Munoz. Back in December, here was J.R. Labby, Vice President of Communications and Community Affairs at JPS Health Network, owning the hospital, saying the hospital was keeping her alive, explaining that stance to WFAA-TV.
We have a responsibility of making sure that we follow the laws, whether they are state or federal, when it comes to providing care to patients, and that's what we're doing in this case.
There was the voice of the hospital. They apparently considered an appeal over the weekend, but in the end did not. Tom Mayo, standby in Dallas. Emily Bazelon joins us right now, senior editor at Slate, contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine, and law, strong law background herself. She joins us today from San Francisco. Emily, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Is Texas a complete one-off here? If people look at a map of the nation here, are there other states where something like this could conceivably happen under state law?
Yes, there are at least a dozen states and maybe a few more scattered around the country in which even if you have a written directive saying do not resuscitate, if you are pregnant, the hospital is supposed to give life-sustaining treatment to bring the fetus to term. Now, I don't think that's what this hospital did. I think this was an extreme interpretation of that law since this woman was brain dead. There couldn't be life-sustaining treatment for her. But the idea that this kind of thing could happen, yes, other states have definitely passed those sorts of laws.
Tom Mayo, what about viability of the fetus? Does that come into play here? I mean, it was 14 weeks. What if it was 2 days or a week? Is there no lower limit?
Well, I think there's no lower limit if you read this statute as requiring treatment. We do have, as Joe Poyman pointed out earlier, we do have a law that says that essentially life begins at conception for purposes of our penal code and our wrongful death statute. I suppose you could apply that same law to the pregnancy exclusion we're talking about. But one thing I want to make clear here, and it's a point that tends to get lost in these discussions, mm-hmm. two sections later in 166.051, the statute says that this law does not change any rights or responsibilities that exist under Texas law. That is to say, our statute did not change Texas law by imposing a requirement. This is an immunity statute. It says that if you act under this subchapter or within this act, if you act consistently with the statute, you get legal immunities. If you do not act as the statute prescribes, you lose those immunities, but you're not acting unlawfully, you're not breaking the law.
Does that mean the hospital, you're suggesting the hospital was right to be concerned that it might have been prosecuted if it had let Marlies Munoz die and the fetus as well?
Yeah. I don't know if that's what they were considering, but they had a choice. Even if the statute could apply, and I don't think it could, I agree with Emily Bazelon, that it does not apply to a dead patient. Even if it did, they would still have the choice of following the statute and securing these legal immunities or not. They had a choice.
Emily, is this application of law run amok? How do you look at what just happened?
I think that this hospital took an extreme interpretation of this law. Because this woman was brain dead, as opposed to being in a coma or in some kind of condition where it was possible that life could return to her. And so the patient, the hospital also put the potential rights of the fetus above the mother, even though the fetus was only at 14 weeks and we learned last week was not even viable. So all of those facts really are not good facts for the side, the anti-abortion side, the side of keeping fetuses alive no matter what, because it's so extreme. But I think there is this underlying issue here, which is laws that are sort of wedge laws. They appear to, reasonably protect rights of fetuses or even mothers in cases of laws that give an extra punishment for hurting the fetus as well as a pregnant woman. But they're also a way of recognizing the personhood or individuality of the fetus. And in fact, the hospital said in its briefs there are other parts of Texas law that talk about the fetus as an individual, in other words, as a person. And that is very much counter to the constitutional tradition that fetuses are not the same as living, born people. But, there are a lot of laws and states that have sort of tried to push in that direction despite directives from the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court has not completely ruled this out. They have not directly ruled in each of these instances. So that's why you have this gray area.
Tom, I don't know how much you know about this particular hospital or the district attorney who was defending them here, But does it look to you like it was a genuine attempt to conform with Texas law, or does it look like a political statement to keep this non-viable fetus and brain-dead mother going?
Well, I take their words at face value. I don't know enough about the decision-making process to do anything but speculate. I don't think it was a particularly reasonable interpretation of the statute at all. And so the mind starts searching for other explanations. It's a public hospital. The board is appointed by the county commissioners. The county commissioners are elected. So the possibility of political influence can't be completely ruled out.
Let's go to Carter in Barnett, Vermont. Carter, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
It's greed. It's all greed. How much money did it cost to keep that poor lady hooked up for 14 weeks? That's all I got to say. We've not got no morals anymore.
Greed, simple. I mean, you may be right, but they've got a lot of difficult public relations to deal with. I don't know if it'd be worth it, but maybe. Chris in Milwaukee. Chris, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
I'm thinking along the same lines. I'd like to know who's responsible for paying these bills that are incurred with this woman in particular and other cases generally.
I mean, if they're kept alive against the family's wishes, that's an interesting question. Let me hold that one, Chris, and get one more. Francis in West Palm Beach, Florida. Francis, you're on.
Hi, everybody. Not only is this scenario ghoulish, but as a pediatric occupational therapist, I know the fallout from a decision such as this hospital's, a decision based on religious, politically conservative laws, because, you know, I work with disabled children, children with special needs from 0 to 18, no matter what the diagnosis is. So aside from the emotional toll on the family and everyone involved, until the right-wing legislators are willing to raise taxes or pay out of their own pockets for all the medical bills and expenses for supporting these families and the fetuses born at whatever level of function until their death, they shouldn't be legislating their religious views into everybody's lives.
Francis, thanks for your call. Tom Mayo, is it clear, is it possible that the hospital will now turn around and require Marlies Munoz's husband to pay that hospital bill? And if the fetus, if they had succeeded in somehow bringing it to life, despite all these severe challenges it was facing, who would have been responsible for paying for its care for life?
Well, as far as the hospital charges go, it's certainly possible. The hospital has a choice of either absorbing these costs of care or submitting a bill to Mr. Munoz. I assume he has health insurance, and the health insurer would have a choice whether to pay those bills or take the position that since she died on November 28th, anything that was done to her body from that point forward was not medically necessary and appropriate and refused to pay.
Just stunning to contemplate. John in Adams, Tennessee. John, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I just wanted to know if your panel would take a look at the broader issue here. Not just a couple years ago, last election cycle, we were looking at situations where we were being told that the death panels would be assembled in order to save money. We had the Terry Schiavo case where folks, were right up to our senators being involved directly in decision-making processes, or at least trying to influence a decision-making process. And I'm wondering, you know, at this point, we've kind of flipped this on its ear. We've gone from, we have conservatives telling us, government, get out of our decision-making process, and yet these same people are coming around and telling us they're going to decide for families, or at least significantly delay families, in making these decisions. When you're a family in this decision, your clock is running fast. It's painful. It's a very delicate situation, and the legal clock, probably rightfully slow, is much slower to react. But I wonder if you might want to comment on that. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, John. I mean, Emily, this is exactly where lots of our listeners' minds are turning. Michael writes here online, says on Facebook, says it's beyond tragic. It's truly evil to intentionally inflict so much suffering on a family for ideological reasons. Now, of course, defenders of right to life would say it's not ideological, it's moral. But many of our listeners, Emily, Laura says government needs to stay out of our medical decisions. Linda writes, no government should have the right to dictate in this situation, totally up to the wishes of the immediate family. The reason why living wills, healthcare proxies are so very important. But the will of the family here, Emily, seems almost not, it was not considered.
Right.
The dignity of Marlies Munoz herself, where does that come in the law?
I don't think it really does. I mean, what you see here are a collision between two values. There's the idea that life begins at conception and a fetus, viable or not, at any stage deserves to be treated equally as a patient with the mother. And then you have this strong American libertarian streak that the government is supposed to stay out of the business of families and not intrude at these terribly difficult, tragic moments. And this interpretation of this law brought those things into an absolute collision. And so what you saw was the hospital really setting aside this family's wishes and the dignity of Marlies Munoz, at least as channeled through her family.
Would a living will, a written document, have made any difference here?
No, I don't think so. I mean, looking at the way Texas's law is written, and there are about a dozen states that say this, it doesn't matter whether you've written down your wishes or not, because a hospital, a doctor, is supposed to provide life-sustaining treatment as long as there is a chance, in its view, to save the fetus. And again, I don't think I think the hospital went far beyond that in this case, but writing down your directions ahead of time in Texas and some other states does not matter. There are a few other states in which you can have some impact by writing down what you want, and you really have to go and check your own state laws. There are some helpful lists online if you're curious about what your own state is doing.
We'll try and arrange something at our website on that front where people can see what states require what. Stephanie,
I'll send you a good link.
Oh, good. That'll be great. We'll get it up after the show here. Thank you, Emily. Stephanie in East Greenwich, Rhode Island. Stephanie, thank you for calling. You're on.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
The comment that I want to make, and I make this comment as a woman and a very progressive woman and a professional individual,
okay,
is that I fail to understand how murder it can be sanctioned under any circumstance.
Where's the murder, Stephanie? Sorry, where's the murder?
Situation of expediency. And my heart goes out to the family, but as a society and as a culture, we must protect the most vulnerable. And how, and I say this as a progressive woman, how can we ever make an argument that says that for the sake of expediency or because it is practical or whatever, and believe me, my heart goes out to the family, but how can we ever justify not allowing a child to develop fully?
But you say expediency, but what about in a case where the mother is dead, as Tom Mayo says, brain dead, and the fetus is not viable? I mean, what are we doing then?
The baby is not dead. The baby is alive. And you may call it a fetus or a baby, but it is alive. And the death, the very heart-wrenching situation of the mother, but the death of the mother does not need to lead to the death of the baby.
Well, I mean, that baby certainly suffered great trauma in there, and that became increasingly evident, I guess. But I've got your perspective, Stephanie. Colleen in Lancaster, Massachusetts. Colleen, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My comment is more in response to treating them as two separate patients, which I fully respect, but I can't personally imagine a situation where one patient would be kept alive against their family wishes in order to keep alive a completely separate patient against his or her family wishes.
It looks like sort of one unit to you, the woman and the fetus.
Or even if you look at them as completely separate patients, you're keeping one patient alive against their own and their family wishes in order to keep alive a separate patient whose father and grandparents do not wish for them to be kept alive at the expense of someone else.
It seems like a big state intervention. Thank you, Colleen. Stan in Madison, Wisconsin. Stan, our time is short. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm a physician. I just want to make one point that we not consider the role of the physician as enabler. This is a grotesque violation of the Hippocratic Oath. I think every physician has a moral, ethical position to take, and in this case, it's gone completely out of whack.
What's the offense to the Hippocratic Oath here, Stan?
Well, in the Hippocratic Oath, it says, first, do no harm. That's the first requirement.
If the woman was dead, are they doing harm to her by keeping her womb active?
Absolutely. This is a grotesque distortion, and it's clearly a violation of the Hippocratic Oath.
Stan, thank you. Tom Mayo, should the doctors in this hospital have, on ethical grounds, declined to be party to this?
I would have thought they would. This is so far outside the standard of care, such as it is. This is really experimentation and without anything close to proper consent.
A pregnancy in a cadaver, Lawrence McDonald at Baylor College of Medicine called it. Emily Bazelon, do you think public pushback on this front will turn things around, send things in a different direction, or is this the road we're going down in Texas and beyond?
I think it's very hard to imagine a more pro-choice kind of bill.
Well, if that's what you want to call it, the family here will finally have some peace in Texas. Emily Bazelon with Slate, thank you very much for being with us today. Tom Mayo at Southern Methodist University, thank you for joining us, Tom. Listeners, thanks for your comments and thoughts in this hour. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.